Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A small group of black pilots fought for the right to fly in World War II. They became known as the Tuskegee Airmen. Their success permanently changed the face of the United States military, as well as contributions in the course of the war itself. Dr. Harold Brown was one of the 992 original Tuskegee pilots. He's written a book, and it's called Keep Your Airspeed Up, The Story of a Tuskegee Airman. He joins us now on the phone from Ohio. Colonel Brown, welcome.
Fine.
Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tell us what life was like for you there as a child in Minnesota, as a young black child in Minnesota. What was the environment like?
Well, yes, I did grow up in Minnesota. Keep in mind, when I was a youngster up there, we had the Great Depression that started in 1929. We were all poor and hungry, and there was only a small percentage of us up there, nothing more but a fraction of 1%. And the neighborhood I lived in was pretty much an integrated neighborhood, really. I had Swedish people on one side, Norwegians on the other, two Mexican families right behind me, a Jewish family, and we were all had our little small community. We were all poor as church mouses. We didn't even have locks on the door because there was nothing worth stealing in the houses. So life was good. And of course, being in Minneapolis, in that environment, I had little or no segregation that I saw when I was a youngster growing up.
Tell me when you first wanted to fly, to be a combat pilot. What created that yearning for you?
Well, that's a good question. I'm often asked that question, and I really don't have an answer. My only answer is that I was about 11 years old in the sixth grade, and I often refer to it as having a love affair with an airplane. And for some unknown reason, the flying bug just hit me, and I just fell in love with airplanes. And, of course, what followed was I went into the building model airplane mode and continued that. I was reading every book I could possibly find in the library about the Army Air Corps, is what it was called in those days. There was one book I used to read regularly. It was entitled Randolph Field, Texas, West Point of the Air, and I read that book almost every Saturday in the library to the extent that I could almost memorize it. But that was it, and I can't give you any more definitive reason as to why it happened. It just happened, and I just latched on to it, and I never let go of it.
When was the moment that you realized that that might be open to you? When did you hear about the possibilities that you could receive combat flight training at all?
Well, let's go back a few years. I used to deliver a paper, the black weekly papers like the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, and there was any number of them for the largest cities. And I knew that this was going on because it was highly publicized. And I kept up with it. And I can recall back in 38, 39, that's when the great debate started. And the debate was all about whether or not they were going to allow us to fly aircraft. And, of course, I was quite interested because I often thought about flying, but when I thought about flying, I immediately thought about military flying. So that was very, very key to me. And I followed those debates for the next 2 years until 1941, when the debate ended, when Franklin Roosevelt said, well, that's it. And he announced one squadron, fighter squadron, that would be formed and training would start immediately. He announced that in March of 1941. The first class was announced in July of 1941. And that was 6 months before we were even at war. That didn't start until, as you know, back in December of 1941. So that's generally of what was going on at that time, and delivering newspapers, I kept up to date with it. Obviously, very, very close, and watched it all unfold.
One of the reasons that this wasn't allowed was because the United States military is segregated. There's no training place for black airmen to train. Tell me a little bit about your mother's advice as you first head to Alabama. She's been to the South before. You haven't. What does she tell you before you head to training in Tuskegee, Alabama?
Well, like I said, I was raised in the Minneapolis, so I knew very little about the good old segregated South. So after I graduated from high school in June of 1942, at 17 years of age, I immediately went down to set for the exam. And keep in mind, at that time, they wanted people to be college-trained people. But you can imagine, back in those days, they only had a handful of them, and they rapidly depleted those group of pilots, and that's when they decided, hey, we'll take high school kids. If they can pass the mental and the physical exams, we'll accept them. And those are the conditions that were set up for me, and which I took in June of 1942. And, of course, I passed them. And I didn't hear anything for the next 6 months until December, and that was when I got the letter that I was accepted. And back to your question, now comes Mother Brown explaining to me how I must behave once I go down south, since my mother and father are both from Alabama. And that took over the next several weeks, and of course, me being, oh, Mama, come on, yak, yak, and I kind of shrugged my whole shoulders. And but she insisted that you listen to me, boy. You haven't been south. I know how it is down there. So I listened to her. However, it went in one ear and out the other. And it wasn't until I took the train from Minneapolis to Chicago, and in Chicago I traded trains in the across the Mason-Dixon line about midnight, and that's where I ran into the good old segregated South. And I went up to the gentleman at the ticket desk, and I asked him, can you tell me what track the train for Biloxi, Mississippi comes in on? And he very politely told me, well, I have to go around the corner, and that gentleman would take care of me at the next window around the corner. So I walked around to the corner, and the exact same man comes up to me and says, yes, can I help you? And I thought, that's the same guy I was just talking to. And he asked me, and I posed the exact same questions, and he told me. And then I happened to look up, and I saw the big sign that said colored on top of the window. Then I looked at the other sign, and it had white over at the other window. So that was my introduction to the segregated South.
You write in the book that as you're doing your training, you are really representing everyone who has black skin in America. You're being judged. They're being judged. So much is at stake. Tell me more about that feeling that if you fail in your training, so much more is at stake than what's at stake for you individually.
Well, to be quite honest, I really wasn't that quite sophisticated in my thinking. Keep in mind, I was nothing but a young teenager, 17 years of age. And when I was eventually called, I had just turned 18 and I was on my way. And I was just a young kid like most of them were, and all I wanted to do was fly airplanes. And that was my big concern. But the best way to learn how to fly an airplane was through military flight training. any other way was just cost prohibitive. So it wasn't that I was going into the military. It was more the fact that I was going to learn to fly an aircraft. So in those early days, we knew that things were going to be tough, and they were very, very rigorous for us, and many, many obstacles and challenges that we had to face. But it was a very difficult program. And, of course, we being who we were, black pilots, or trained to be black pilots, we also had other obstacles that, of course, the white pilots didn't have. And because we were in a segregated society. And being in a segregated society, we had all of the problems of being segregated that we had to face. So that even made the whole thing that much problematical. Because, one, not only was the training difficult, but being segregated, we knew that they would only have a small percentage of us that they would ever allow to become pilots. So that just increased the problems because they had an extremely high washed-out rate because there was a quota system that we also had to face. And that made it extremely difficult. But it wasn't until really in my older age, after I was in the military and I had grown a bit and became a little smarter, that I fully realized that we had done something quite wonderful. And, of course, that became even more evident to us when in 1948, President Truman integrated the military. And we were integrated in 1949. Now, that was 16 years before the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. And that would have never happened had we not performed in an outstanding manner. It would never have happened, but it did. And that is when it really hit us, well, we have really done something wonderful. But until that time, we just lived our own segregated life as pilots, and that's the way it was.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Dr. Harold Brown, retired Lieutenant Colonel. His book is called Keep Your Airspeed Up. It just came out in 2017. Dr. Brown, your first experience really in integration in the military is surprisingly when you become a POW.
you picked up on that, huh?
You're right.
And of course, I joke about it in the book that the first time I was integrated was in a prisoner of war camp. There's something somewhat ironic about that. But nevertheless, that was my first experience. And keep in mind, there was only a handful of us flying. There was only a total of 355 of us that fought the war overseas. And out of those, 32 of us became prisoner of wars. And obviously, I'm certain they weren't going to build any special prison camps for these little 32 black guys who happened to get shot down and was prisoners. So we were just thrown into the mix, and they didn't even give it a second thought. And, of course, we didn't give it a second thought. Other than the fact that it was a joke to us, well, we're now integrated for the first time in a W cab.
There is in the book some photographs of the notebook that you have at this time, and I find it fascinating. You mentioned being young in the Depression and being hungry. Here you are hungry again and making lists of things like food that you'll eat when you're free again.
Well, that's true. You know, when you're POW, you're just sitting there. You're behind barbed wire, and there's absolutely nothing for you to do except just to mill around and talk to each other. And the poor Germans could hardly feed their own military. They were almost as hungry as we were. Not quite, but they were having a very difficult time. They were losing the war, and they just didn't have the food to feed us. So here we were just sitting around, and you were constantly hungry. So the topic always reverted to, boy, what are we going to eat once this war is over with? And that was our favorite topic, talking about our favorite foods and what we were going to do. And matter of fact, I had a little diary, and I even kept track of all of the foods that I wanted to eat once I get out. But that was our favorite topic, food eating. And of course,
was that
survival, trying to stay alive, even though
right.
we lost.
That's what I was going to say. That gave you hope in some ways to have those kind of conversations. Why do you think you kept, or how do you think those conversations helped you move forward?
Using than anything else. And it stands to reason that if you got that much time on your hands, and if that is your favorite, that is your primary concern is eating, then that's going to be your primary conversation. Is food, and that was the way it was. But reflecting back on it, it was somewhat amusing in a way, but at the time it was very, very real laws.
Right.
All of us came out of prison camp who had lost a lot of weight. I was already thin enough. I only weighed 129 pounds when I went into the military, and I was thin as a rail, and I could even count my ribs when I was liberated. So, but that was all part of surviving, eating what we could eat. And what kept us alive is that the International Red Cross was able to get food parcels into us. And they tried to get us a food parcel at least once a week. Sometimes they didn't, but quite often they did. And that's what kept us going. That's what kept us alive.
You stay in the military after the war and continue to fly. Why did you make it your career?
Well, I always wanted to fly, and I felt I was very, very fortunate. I had dreamed about it, and I was living out my dreams. I had dreamed of becoming a military fighter pilot. I had accomplished that. That is precisely what I wanted, and I think I was extremely fortunate in that we all have dreams, but I actually lived out my dreams. And for that, I will always be extremely thankful. That doesn't happen to too many people, but it happened to me. I was fortunate enough to live out my dreams.
There's a film made about the Tuskegee Airmen in 1995, and America largely did not know this story. When that film came out, how did your life change?
Well, we were the best-kept secret in the military. No one heard of us. Very little was known about us. It was never publicized. It was never written in any of the history books. Nothing. It was just a big secret, and it continued to be a secret until that movie came out over HBO. And incidentally, that movie came out. The person who produced that movie was a very dear friend of mine and my classmate, Bob Williams. We were in the same class together. We went overseas together. We fought together. And when he came home, he was out living in Pasadena, and he had a few part-time plays in the movie. And then he decided to write his own story. And he wrote his own story. Matter of fact, I read the original manuscript. And then he thought, boy, I need to make a movie about this. And he set about to do that. Now, every time he would earn an extra $1 million, the cost of the movie would go up $2 million. So a good friend of his said, Bob, you'll never get enough money to make this movie. Let's go to HBO. They went to HBO, and they proposed the project to HBO, and HBO said, we'll let you know. 10 years later, HBO contacted them and said, yes, we are now ready to take on the project. So 10 years later. So here, Bob, who had this dream some 30-odd years before, finally had his dream of making a movie about the Tuskegee Airmen. And that was just some of the background of how that movie came. into being. But that is also what actually put our name on the bat. Because up until that time, we were nothing but a secret. No one knew a thing about us. And then all of a sudden, we got a lot of notoriety. People learned about us primarily from that movie, the HBO movie that came out.
Dr. Brown, in your lifetime, and you're in your 90s now, so much has changed for African Americans. Much work left to be done. What do you tell people now about what needs to happen in America next regarding racial equality?
Well, we just need to just keep plugging away at it. We've had a great deal of good things have happened, and it has been a climb, but it's been a very steady climb. And the climb has been continuing and continuing. And you look at across the spectrum in our society today, we're in every part of that society. We have prominent people in all positions within that society. We've even had a black president, which I never thought I would see in my lifetime. So it is a fight that is continuing. And it will continue, and it will continue until one of these days, there will not be a problem. And everyone, regardless of their color of their skin, whether they're white, black, green, purple, or whatever they are, will be accepted. And we will get there. Yes, there has been a few stumbling blocks along the way, but we're still making a lot of progress. It's interesting that you should raise that question today. You might have heard about Oprah Winfrey and the great speech she did at the over television the other night. And now they're talking about Oprah might be thinking about running for president. So, you know, now wouldn't that be something if she were to run for president and win it? But this is life in America. And it is a good life. I wouldn't trade my life in America for anything in the world. It's the greatest country in the world, no question about it. But we got some problems. But we will eventually resolve all of the problems. It will happen. It may not happen during my lifetime, but I'm certain within another generation or two, all the problems will have vanished, hopefully.
Harold Brown, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your work in education. Thank you for this book. We appreciate it.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I certainly enjoyed the conversation with you.